Good morning again, and happy Easter. I think one of the, I guess you'd say, shockingly frustrating things about raising children, which could be any number of things, is when, at least for me, when they start developing language and start using words in a more sophisticated way. Because inevitably, you will, in normal conversation, use a word that you use every day, multiple times a day, take your pick, and they'll say, "What does that mean?" And you'll stare at them and realize that this word that you've said your entire life, you could not write a dictionary definition for. Like, I have no idea how to explain what the word constitution means to a child. It's much easier if they say, like, "Well, what does the word truck mean?" You can just go, "Truck." But if it's more abstract, and therefore more expressive, good luck. And the reason why I bring that up is, how would you define to a five-year-old what the word hope means? And now, hope is something we probably use more or less every day. But if even I were to ask you, like, how would you define to me what the word hope means in a way that doesn't make it sound like it's just a wish, what would you say? Because usually we use the word hope to mean a wish or a desired outcome. Like, I hope that I win the lottery or something. You are not in any kind of deeper philosophical, theological sense, expressing some kind of trust or there's nothing influenced by the machinations of fate, or you're not expecting God to step in and intervene. At least I sincerely hope not. You just really want to win the lottery so you can tell your boss what you're really thinking and then leave. However, what do we mean when we use the word hope? Well, if you weren't here on Good Friday, where we recognize and in some ways reenact the death of Jesus, we talked about how hope was slowly fading. The disciples had followed Jesus for his entire career. There were more than just the 12. And there was a sense of expectation and, dare I say, hope. As Jesus is going to Jerusalem, this would not have been the first time he had made it to the holy city. It seems like this was a fairly regular thing. And yet this time was different. And the expectations and anticipations were high. In other words, there was a sense of hope, this anticipation of something really good happening. And then, after a week of Jesus teaching and alienating basically everybody in power, he's betrayed. And the sense of hope that his disciples may have had takes a real big hit. This is not supposed to happen. And then as he is given trumped up charges of blaspheming the temple and so on and so forth, and then he is tried before the Roman governor, who honestly just wants to be left alone and is more than happy to trade human life for expediency and an easy way out, you start to see hope fade entirely. Because this was not supposed to happen. Nobody ever expected the Messiah or the God's holy chosen one to die. God's holy chosen one is supposed to make the enemies of Israel die. He got it in reverse. And once Jesus, once his fate is sealed, most of his disciples scatter. John seems to be the exception here because he's young enough. He's not identified as a potential leader of this movement, and so they're not going to go after him. But the other disciples, they have to hide. The women are not yet identified as leaders of the movement. They will within the next year, by the way. And so they're I guess in support of Jesus, they're there as hope just bleeds out in front of them with hope's mother standing next to them. I can't imagine the grief. And then it's Sabbath. Once the sun sets, there is no work, there's no travel, nothing can be done. And you're quite literally required by law to rest. And so can you imagine having one of the worst moments of your life? Watching this person in whom you have put all kinds of hope and trust, whatever the word hope may mean, only to watch all of that unravel. He dies, he's very quickly buried, and then you just get to sit at home and do nothing but ruminate on what you just experienced. That's how you kill the human spirit. And so as Matthew is telling his perspective of the final moments of Jesus' life and then after, in other words, our gospel reading for today, we're now at the end of that. So Saturday night is when, or at sundown, is when the Sabbath ends, but you're not going to go wandering around Jerusalem at night. That seems kind of dangerous. It did not work out great for Jesus, as it turns out. And then Sunday morning, first day of the week, you can get up, you can go out, you can do work, and Mary, and then the other Mary, because Mary was a common name, find their way to the tomb. This is what you do when you are stricken with grief. Other gospel writers will fill in the detail that they were going to go and help prepare the body. The only problem is that there's a big old stone in front of it. And I think the women were not aware that Pontius Pilate had ordered some guards to make sure that his disciples didn't snatch the body and say, hey, he's raised from the dead. Because apparently there was a rumor floating around that Jesus said that was going to happen. Nobody believed it. I think even his disciples didn't really believe it. Because even though they are ancient people and we might say that some of their ways are primitive, they're not dumb. They're not naive. They know, out of just the law of what it means to be human, that dead people stay dead. That's how it works. In the same way that they that if you rewind and go back to Christmas, Joseph was not really stressed out when he heard that Mary, his betrothed, was pregnant because he didn't know what was going on. He was stressed out because he knew where babies come from and he knew how that worked, and that's a problem. He was not involved. And in the same way, they know how life works. They know how life begins. They know how it ends. And so they approach the tomb. There's guards there to make sure nobody runs off. And then for Matthew, a whole bunch of things happen all at the same time as he is telling the story. It's a chaotic moment. And how could it not have been? There's a light, there's an earthquake, the stone rolls away, the guards fall over, passed out, I guess. I don't know what the mechanism there is. I'm not a doctor, but I do remember seeing footage of like younger women seeing the Beatles for the first time passing out, so maybe it's that. I don't know. If you have any other theories, let me know. Is it weird that the women don't pass out? I would have thrown up and then passed out. But the women stand there just going, huh, why? I don't know. I don't know why. But they are... apparently braver than the guards. Maybe they're kind of at the point where they have nothing left to lose. It's really hard to intimidate somebody who truly has nothing left to lose. Nevertheless, I love the image of this angel, this great messenger in dazzling white, after this traumatic moment of this big old stone shifted to the side, the tomb opened, and the angel's just like sitting on the stone going, sup? Don't be afraid. It's like fear. I haven't had a chance to be afraid yet. I'm too much in shock. And then he says, he told you he was going to rise. He's not here. You can look inside. He'll meet you in Galilee. Now, I can only imagine the conflicted response within them. And if you read side by side all of those moments when Jesus' resurrection is announced, or when people encounter the resurrected Jesus for the first time, it is not a very simple black and white, they were sad and now they're happy. It's more like they were grief-stricken and hopeless, and now do they dare hope that what is happening in front of them is actually true? And so this angel says, now go tell his disciples that he will meet them in Galilee. And that makes the women the first apostles, the first messengers of the gospel to the 11. We don't talk about that one guy. And to announce that everything that he said, that they had no categories to understand, is in fact true. It in fact happened. And they will meet him when they go back home. What do you do with that? Because up until that moment, everybody knew that dead people stayed dead. And another way, or a different way, to view trial of Jesus, the trial in scare quotes, where the Roman governor Pontius Pilate is there really just to keep everybody from trying to kill everybody else, and Jesus, who is there completely innocent and carrying a sort of presence that is deeply unsettling to Pontius Pilate, you have the showdown between what we might call empire and community. The late Jewish historian and philosopher Mark Ellis would remark about kind of that whole story, that at any time, human beings are moving either towards empire or community. Empire in the sense of domination of will, domination through violence, peace by killing everybody else who disagrees with you, or community, where human beings come together in relationship in the way that we were meant to, in a way that is the opposite of empire, that rather than ruling through domination and force of will, instead we seek peace through justice and community, mutual respect and love, equality, equity, those kinds of things. But when Pontius Pilate is interrogating Jesus, it's these two worlds colliding. And empire will always use death as its tool. That's just how they all work. And so they did. And as we noticed on Friday evening, Good Friday, all of that tendency to use violence and all that tendency to disavow what we know to be true comes crashing on Jesus, and it utterly expends him. And then these women, Mary and then the other Mary, are now the first witnesses to what might actually happen if that last great tool of empire and evil no longer is effective. Death is that final tool. What if it doesn't stick? What if for the first time it doesn't have the final word over somebody's life? This is not something that they were prepared to deal with. And I would argue that the same can be true for us. Because when we talk about hope, we usually just express a wish or a desire. Again, I hope I win the lottery. I well, at least 2 weeks ago, I hope that the lines at the TSA aren't so long that I miss my flight. I hope that the situation in the Middle East resolves in peace. I hope that my family doesn't drive me crazy at Easter dinner. That's theoretical, by the way. I hope that I still have a job in 3 weeks. I hope that that diagnosis isn't as scary as it sounds like it's going to be. I hope that I still have my health this time next year. I hope that my family can figure this out. I hope that my relationships that are crumbling or fracturing don't fall apart. These are all just wishes. Resurrection invites us to think about hope in a different way. Because in order to have the moment of resurrection, you must have death. It would make no sense for Jesus to suddenly start wandering around saying, "I've been raised from the dead," prior to Good Friday. I could tell you right now, "I have defeated death." And you would say, "How? You didn't die." You cannot have Easter Sunday without Good Friday. You cannot have hope without despair. When those women, Mary and Mary, suddenly see the angel sitting, I'd like to think just kind of relaxing on the stone, because why wouldn't you be smug if you've got the most important good news in the history of humanity? They're invited to hope in something entirely different. And it's not just a very superficial, easygoing kind of hope. It's the kind of hope that takes despair and sadness, pain and struggle and suffering very seriously. It's a hope that actually isn't an escape from the hard realities of life. It's a hope that takes you through the realities of life and changes you for the better. That if the final say over your life should be, and frankly will be, death, hope in the resurrection sense tells you that death is no longer the final word over your life. The Apostle Paul, 20-ish years later, will remind his people that what God did for Jesus, he will do for us. Hope is the opposite of despair, while taking despair deeply, seriously. Taking the struggle and suffering, the sadness and grief of life seriously. And then adds the final word. You know, have you ever been in like an argument or something like that with somebody who has to have the last word? I've been told it's maddening. I love the last word. Yeah, I've been told it's hard to live with. In the case of Jesus, his resurrection is the last word. And for his followers, it's not hard to live with, it's impossible to die with. What if wherever you are, whatever anxieties and struggles, suffering, whatever you are having a hard time pulling yourself together for, what if the moments where the alarm goes off and you wake up and you go, "I'm not getting out of bed today"? What if the things that that really, really could completely derail your life? What if the fracturing of relationships, what if the just global instability that it feels like we're seeing right now, what if all of that can either be the last word or the prelude to resurrection? How would it change your outlook? What if, as Jesus pops out of that grave and begins this new reality of the human experience, where our deepest, darkest sins and desires, the things we would share with nobody else, those nagging thoughts that won't go away, the tendency to be the problem in our relationships rather than the solution, the regrets and the shame that we carry with us, and also just the sadness and grief of loss. What if all of that, in a very real way, once Jesus leaves that grave and kicks off this new movement, is in fact an invitation to see reality differently? That all of the grief and all of the sorrow and pain and struggle, shame, suffering, and sadness that we all experience and we all know all too well is simply our Good Friday. And it is a prelude to God redeeming and renewing all things. What if the story he is telling through that grief and that shame and that guilt is, in its own very complicated way, merely a signpost pointing to a bigger, greater reality? Now you can see why, when that angel told Mary and the other Mary that, oh, he's not here, just like he said, only for them to go running back to the disciples, encountering Jesus in almost a haunting sort of way, that they see him, and if you read very carefully, you'll notice they then grab for his feet. How do you make any sense of that other than that means that they're on the ground? That is the proper posture when you see someone that you watch die suddenly standing in front of you. You hit the ground. Only for them to reach out and say, everything that we thought was sad is unraveling and turning into something beautiful. That's why we celebrate Easter. That's why Easter is, as a follower of Jesus, the most important day of the year. Because it is the moment when our human experience, as hopeless and full of despair as it can seem some days, as we watch the world unravel, it feels like sometimes in front of us, that but if God raised Jesus from the dead and he promises to do the same for you, then he promises to be with you and me in that resurrection power, in a way that nothing can touch you, that Jesus cannot redeem. Whatever that may mean, and however you can reduce that to a single paragraph that would fit in the Merriam-Webster dictionary, that's hope. I don't know how to explain it to a 5-year-old. And if it were possible for a writer of the Bible to just give us a brief definition of hope, I think they would have. But instead of giving us a definition, Jesus gave us a story. And it's not a one-off moment that happened 2,000 years ago, but it's a story that continues to live out today. That's why we hope. And that's why for the last, I think it dates back to about 200, for the last about 1,800 years, on Easter, Christians, followers of Jesus throughout our history, have greeted each other by saying, "He is risen."
He is risen indeed. Hallelujah.
Amen. Please rise as you're able.